This program comes from Bloomsterhus, filled with plants and herb starts for the spring. Open 10 to 5, Monday through Saturday. Bloomsterhus on Main Street, Facebook, and at 907-772-2566.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a big homegrown tomatoes.
Hello and welcome back to In the Garden. I'm your host, Daniel Rowan Tucker. Thanks for joining me today. Rain is back, and it feels like we're turning the corner into fall after that last glorious stretch of sunshine. That might be all we get for a while, but it feels like there was a real summer after all. Over the weekend, I was very fortunate to have a chance to visit the home and gardens of the Sprague family on Saspe Island and to sample the many fruits of their labors, an experience that brought to mind the legendary Isle of the Blessed from Celtic mythology. This historic homestead is a local icon overlooking the mouth of the Narrows and Petersburg's waterfront on a south-facing sunny knoll perched just above the high tide line. Gardens and greenhouses overflowing with fruit and vegetables are set amid grassy lawns and thimbleberry patches, with a raised boardwalk winding through it all up to the main residence. Larger trees and shrubs are sprinkled around the outer reaches in a park-like setting, with the wall of deep, mossy forest immediately behind it, providing shelter from northerly winds. A buried water pipe runs for nearly a mile from the homestead up to a mountainside spring on Kuprinoff Island, powering a hydroelectric generator that provides most of their electricity, as well as supplying the Spragues with an abundance of pure, clean water. Dick and Sharon Sprague were interviewed on this show last year by Craig Olson and Deb Hurley. And after my visit to Saspe Island on Sunday, I felt strongly that their place deserves a repeat appearance. It has everything you could want in a southeast Alaska garden. The Spragues have been growing and building there for about 50 years, and their daughter and son-in-law live just down the beach on Kuprinoff. So, on to the garden. There were raspberries, of course, some of the best I've ever tasted, large and flavorful, of the variety Cascade Delight. Porcupines are a problem with the raspberries, of course. Fences provide some protection, but ultimately a shotgun is what keeps the berry patch safe. Multiple raspberry patches were there, some growing outdoors and covered in the growing season with a simple temporary roof of polycarbonate panels. Other outdoor patches were not covered, which appeared to be a little less productive, especially this year for all the rain we had this spring during the bloom season. And they also have ever-bearing raspberry varieties in a greenhouse that Sharon said are very productive in the shoulder seasons. And then in the various greenhouses, his and hers respectively, where they used painter's plastic stretched beneath the top of the greenhouse on the inside to catch the dripping condensation before it gets on the plants. It's a good trick to use around here because all that condensation inside a greenhouse can cause a lot of mold issues and other problems. We got to taste grapes from several grapevines of the variety Somerset. The grapes were small, not that much bigger than currants, but very sweet and flavorful, really delicious, and quite productive. Tomatoes, cherry-sized tomatoes up to plum-sized and very flavorful. I'll have to ask them again for the names of those varieties. It sounds like they've grown quite a few different ones over the years, and Dick likes to save the seeds whenever he can to start the next generation. And basil right alongside the tomatoes, the perfect accompaniment to tomatoes in a greenhouse. I think the smell of fresh basil makes almost any kitchen seem like heaven. dill also thriving in the greenhouses. Squashes, both zucchini and winter squash, maturing well. Cucumbers, watered with a little chicken manure mixed in with the water to keep those heavy feeders green and growing with lots of nitrogen. And back outdoors into the various garden patches fenced off from the deer. They had a really impressive-looking rhubarb plant of a Russian variety brought to Skagway during the gold rush, looking amazing with leaves as big as umbrellas. Big strawberry patch, also covered seasonally during the growing season with polycarbonate panels similar to the raspberry patches, which are held up with a simple structure of steel T-posts, so those steel fence posts that you can get at Alaska Fiber or other places, and then wooden slats secured between them just above head height, around 7 feet high, and the polycarbonate just slightly slanting, laying flat on top of those wooden slats and tied down with seine twine. And they take that down in the winter because, of course, it wouldn't stand up to the snow. And it's just to keep the rain off during the blooming and fruiting season for those delicate, soft fruits like strawberries and raspberries. So that's a good kind of simple technique there. And polycarbonate panels are not cheap, but they can last quite a long time. They're pretty tough as long as they don't blow away in the wind. And I've had a good experience making all kinds of garden structures with polycarbonate panels. They had a lot of cabbages, both red and green, big, huge basketball-sized cabbages, just beautiful looking. Kale, broccoli, cauliflower, carrots, potatoes, which were about to be harvested. Sharon said she takes her cue on when to harvest potatoes from David Holmes. He and his wife Anna Holmes grow quite a lot of potatoes at their place out the road. They're quite the potato growers. They had a couple of different apple trees, including a centennial crab apple, which Dick said was a good producer, really delicious apple, crab apple, you know, about the size of a ping pong ball on average, but very, very flavorful and somewhat sweet as well. Probably a little bit of an improvement on the Dolgo variety, which we also have a number of around town. In my experience, Centennial is a little bit bigger and sweeter than Dolgo, but I have yet to compare them as grown here in Petersburg. But anyways, they had a Centennial crab apple, which sounds like was highly prized. This year, wasn't many apples. The rain this spring really nixed the pollination for the bees, for the pollinators. And so the apple crop wasn't very much. There were a few on some of the trees, but not very impressive. But they said that they do get quite substantial harvests in better years, buckets full of apples. Dick had a graft on a native crab apple that they said was very productive sometimes. I think it was over a decade old, and the trunk on that graft was, you know, at least as big as your arm. So doing quite well, creating a healthy and productive apple tree. I don't remember the variety that they had grafted onto the native crab. But folks, this is a great opportunity. Wild crab apples grow all over the place here, kind of a nondescript, innocuous, shrubby, sprawly, small tree. But once you learn to identify them, they're pretty easy to find all over town, and especially along the beaches, all along the narrows, usually kind of growing out from under the lower branches of a big spruce tree on a nice sunny beach somewhere. There's lots of them at Point Agassiz too. They're quite tolerant of wet soil. They're actually the most tolerant of water logging of any apple species in the world, from what I've heard from some very knowledgeable growers down south. And this is the native Pacific crab apple, Malus fusca. And the leaves look very similar to apple leaves, but they often have three little points to the leaf, like a slight trident shape, very slightly, with the middle point still being much bigger than the two on the sides, or sometimes they're forked with just one little side point coming out. And of course the characteristic teeny tiny pea-sized super sour but very flavorful apples that they produce. But these native crab apples can be cut back and grafted onto with any domestic apple variety. They're very much graft compatible. I don't know that there's any incompatibility issues as long as the graft is good, and the plant is healthy and the scion's in good condition. I haven't heard of any issues with certain apple varieties not working on Malus fusca. And there's quite a few people down south, even in Washington, Oregon, that graft apples onto Malus fusca. I was at Burnt Ridge Nursery years ago, and Michael Dolan, who's a complete walking encyclopedia of all things fruit and nut for the Pacific Northwest, showed us an apple tree that he'd grafted onto a native Malus fusca 20 years before, and it was a big, vigorous tree, producing tons of apples. I know of some people on Whidbey Island, I believe, planting out orchards of apple varieties grafted onto Malus fusca. So I think there's a lot of opportunities there. It's way tougher and more adapted to our cold climate and wet soils than most of the rootstocks that you will find on apple trees from a nursery. So a lot of opportunities for experimentation there. And Dick Sprague is leading the way with what they've got there over on Saspy. Several varieties of cherries, again, like the apples, productivity is variable depending on the season, how much rain during the bloom time, and the ripening. One of the older cherry trees had died, but they had several others that looked pretty healthy, and again, seemed like maybe the pie cherries were a bit more rugged and hardy, and the sweet cherries a little more finicky. They had an apricot tree, which I was really impressed with, growing inside of a sort of greenhouse / chicken coop structure in an area where the chickens had been until recently, and they'd fenced them all out to keep them from tearing up the apricot leaves on the tree, which apparently they would do. But man, that apricot tree, and it was, you know, just a couple years that had been in the ground there, was already you know, a good 7 feet tall or 8 feet tall, and just healthy as could be, super green and vigorous. I mean, putting on 3 foot shoots growing out of that composted chicken bedding, just very, one very happy tree inside of that nice warm greenhouse like structure. And Sharon said they've had couple of crops of really good apricots off of it, so that's one to watch out for. I had seen peaches in a greenhouse here before that can be productive, but hadn't seen apricots before, so was quite impressed with that. On to the ornamentals, there were some clematis vines of the Jack Mannii variety, beautiful big blossoms and pale mauve. That's one we could use more of around town. Sword ferns, now they're not quite as well known as ornamentals, but I think they look very handsome in the garden. The Sprague's have a couple of clumps of sword fern, all propagated from one that they brought up from down south, quite healthy looking. Sharon said the deer do munch on them quite a bit, sometimes in the winter, because they are evergreen. But overall, they look great, and it confirms my hunch that this iconic plant of the Pacific Northwest could be a good addition to our gardens and ponds. They had one small ornamental pond near the house filled by overflow from the hydro line that goes up the mountainside, And this pond makes a wonderful garden feature bedecked with shrubs and water plants. And over on the far side of their property is another overflow stream fed by the hydro line running into an open tank-like structure that Dick said he had previously used as a small-scale hatchery for raising coho fry. He said the cohos would return to the mouth of that tidal creek just below it every year, but feeding those fry for a year beforehand ended up being a bit too much to keep up with in the long run. But ponds, creeks, and other water features are always a focal point in a garden, and I think they could be made more use of around here. And I know everything's sopping wet already. Why do you want more water? There is nothing like a body of clear water, whether still or flowing, to create a sense of peace and health in that space. And ponds create habitat for all kinds of creatures like dragonflies and strange-looking water plants, and they can also create a warmer microclimate immediately around them with the moderating temperature of the water and the increased sunlight reflected from the surface. Their pond had a bunch of monkey weed, a vigorously spreading native water plant with a vaguely prehistoric appearance, like a more succulent version of a horsetail. I thought it was cool. On the south side of their house, facing the water, is what they call the Arizona Room, a large solarium with triple-walled polycarbonate for the roof and double-paned glass windows all around it, as well as a concrete slab floor. Dick remarked on how much this room helps to heat the rest of the house on sunny days. A really great example of passive solar design. And, of course, it's a paradise of houseplants. There was a jade plant with a trunk as thick as my leg, and castor bean plant in a pot, what appeared to be a big clump of papyrus growing in water, geraniums, many others. So spending one last warm, sunny summer day on this delightful island abode felt like the perfect way to end the season before the cold and dark arrive. So many thanks to the Sprags for sharing their bounty of their homestead and the inspiration of what can be grown here with hard work and creativity. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Support for this program comes from Bloomsterhus, filled with plants and herb starts for the spring. Open 10 to 5 Monday through Saturday. Bloomsterhus on Main Street, Facebook, and at 907-772-2566.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you a ripe one, don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a pick. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Well, you can go out to eat, and that's for sure, but it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs. You can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side. Put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Life I lead. Well, I'd be Johnny Tomato Seed, 'cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see.
When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery. Out in the garden, be much better, and I could be pushing up homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown.